Indeed, I want to talk about how our framework of understanding isolated systems changes as soon as we introduce a cosmological constant. So let me switch off the cosmological constant for a little bit and consider just, you know, a normal isolated system, say like a neutron star or two black holes orbiting each other. And then generically, right, if we go far away, the idea is that the space-time curvature dies off and I have approximately a flat space-time. And this is sort of the idea behind asymptotically flat space-times. And they're extremely, extremely powerful. It's a beautiful, rich mathematics, and it allows us to answer all kinds of questions. You know, it's used in all kinds of, you know, gravitational areas of physics, such as, for example, numerical relativity relies heavily on this framework. Also, in mathematics, it's used a lot to prove the positivity of energy. And even in quantum gravity, people use this, for example, in calculating Hawking radiation. So this is a very beautiful framework. But now, you know, if we go back to our star or neutron star or a black hole and switch on the cosmological constant, if I go far away from this system, space-time curvature never dies off, right? I have this cosmological constant. So this framework of asymptotically flat space-times no longer applies. And we need to account for this cosmological constant. So in fact, actually, the situation is still not quite as good as it is for asymptotically flat space-times. We do not have a framework in, you know, full nonlinear general relativity for asymptotically the sitter space-times. But, you know, we can learn already a lot from the linearized case. So studying gravitational perturbations on the sitter background. So that's what I will do today. So I'll tell you why it's difficult to consider this cosmological constant, and then see what are the lessons that we can learn from just doing the simplest possible thing, looking at perturbations off of the sitter background. And I'll focus on like conceptual things and things that, you know, are dramatically different from the asymptotically flat case. So why is it difficult? Well, if we consider an asymptotically flat spacetime, this would be, you know, the generic picture. And if I introduce, say, a star that sits here, wobbles a little bit, and then does nothing again, it will emit gravitational radiation. And that will all end up on Scry. And Scry is a null surface here. And because it's a null surface, it has a very rich structure. And it provides me automatically with a BMS group, which is wonderful, because that allows me to calculate quantities like energy and angular momentum and all that. And we have something that's called the Bondi-Neuse tensor, which fully characterizes gravitational radiation in a nonlinear gauge invariant manner. Now, when I consider spacetimes with a positive cosmological constant, I get a completely different diagram. My triangle is changed into a square, and now this surface where all the radiation ends up is no longer null. It's in fact space-like. And because it's space-like, I no longer have the BMS group. And in fact, I'm stuck with diffeomorphism group on Scry. There's no sort of symmetry reduction happening there. Also, I have no analog of the Bondi-Neuse tensor. So I have no way to really say, OK, what is gravitational radiation? So that's why it's difficult. And that's why I'm not going to talk about it anymore. And let's see what we actually can learn to figure out what to do when we have a cosmological constant by looking at linearized homogeneous fields. So I'm going to introduce a background, the de Sitter background, which, you know, just to get a feel for it, I'll write down the metric in these particular coordinates, conformal coordinates. And where this h squared is related to the cosmological constant in this way. So h squared is lambda over 3. I'll use them interchangeably. So if I look at this chart, if I were to see what a constant r slice looks like, I can tell you that, first of all, I have to notice that this chart doesn't cover all of the sitter spacetime. It only covers half. It covers, in fact, the Poincaré patch. So it's only half of the sitter, so it's this patch, which is the patch that is relevant for cosmology. And as I'll show later on, it's also the part that is relevant for studying isolated systems. So we only cover half of this patch. And if I now look, for example, at a constant r slice, so say that will look like this. So this is my r equals 0 slice. I can look at, you know, some later r. This is like r equals 3, r equals 100. And this surface, this cosmological horizon, is where r equals infinity. That's interesting already. Because when we have a flat space time, what people typically do, right, they expand the gravitational field in this 1 upon r expansion. And that generically works really well, but that because that 1 upon r is large on scry. Here, r is not large on scry. Actually, r effect takes you to this cosmological horizon. So a 1 upon r expansion is not going to be helpful. It's not going to do the trick. It doesn't take you to scry. What instead should you be doing? Well, if you look at constant time slices, they look like this. So this is a constant eta slice. This is another constant eta slice. And this slice, eta equals to 0, is where scry is. So this is lesson number one that we actually already learned from looking at the background, is that a late time expansion is needed to get to scry, not a 1 upon r expansion. Thing that's interesting that you can already see from this is since scry is a space-like surface, all Killing vector fields on scry will be tangential to it and hence will also all be space-like. So this is an important point. All Killing vector fields on scry are space-like. Now why do I stress this point? Well, you know, energy is typically associated to a Killing vector field that generates for you time translations. Time translations, you know, are time-like. So if all your Killing vector fields are space-like on scry, what are you going to call energy? Well, we have the following solution for that. If I draw this diagram again, indeed, in the sitter, we don't have a global time-like Killing vector field, but we do have one sort of half of the sitter, so to say. So if I draw the integral curves of this vector field, they look like this here and like that there. So here in this part, this vector field is indeed time-like. And that's what I will call something my time translation vector field. So, and I'll denote this by TA. So note that it's time-like here, but space-like here. So why are we taking this vector field, which actually looks like this, let me show, in these coordinates? Why do I take this vector field? Well, for two reasons. If I look at Schwarzschild the sitter, I have a proper notion of what I mean by time translation. If I now take that vector field and send the mass to 0, this is the vector field that I end up with. Yes?
So is the charge associated to this what people call the Abbot-Beezer mass?
Actually, I don't know. I don't know. Sorry.
The Abbot-Beezer?
Yeah, there are various charges around, and many of them are called energy, but they do not always refer to this vector field. Do you happen to know about it?
Yeah, so it's Abbot-Beezer mass, but it's calculated special infinity.
Okay.
Not calculated on scry, but then you should say that. So it's calculated. So basically, you go out to on those slices that they're the blue slices, like what you say. Mm-hmm. So those are the conscious slices. Mm-hmm. And then you go out all the way to infinity. And that is a special infinity. So it's really the AVM laser. So it's AVM framework.
Mm-hmm.
And you evaluate the. But your question was different. Your question was, is it associated with the Killing vector?
Yeah.
No. So it's associated as usual with the AVM framework.
Okay.
It is associated with the unit normal to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore that is not a Killing vector.
Right.
And so they can conform a Killing field. So in what sense is it energy is an interesting issue because
mm-hmm.
it's really associated with conform a Killing vector
right.
and not the Killing vector.
Yeah, so it would be just this vector field without this. This is the key. Okay, so let me recap. So this one is the one that you know, the vector field that you naturally obtain from taking the mass to zero from Schwarzschild to sitter. Another reason that it's compelling to take this vector field is that if you take the limit of lambda to zero, you obtain the Killing vector field in Minkowski spacetime. So that's what we're going to take. So now let me introduce the perturbations, as I promised. So for that, I'm going to consider this one parameter family of metrics in the following way. So here I have my background metric, which is the sitter metric, and my perturbations. So where this is the scale factor, which is just, you know, this factor up front here. And I'm going to do something what people do in cosmology a lot, which is just nice for calculations. I'm going to factor out the scale factor also for the perturbations. Just makes calculations simpler. Now, if I take this and linearize Einstein's equations, I obtain the wave equation for this field, which just is, you know, the flat derivative, the Lambertian operator, and then plus 2 upon eta partial eta of h a b equals 0. Now, if you are used to flat spacetimes, you might want to use the geometric optics approximation, which is used everywhere. Doing that, however, would mean that I set this term to 0 from the beginning. And that is OK. That term is indeed small, but only if you restrict yourself to this part. So as soon as you're sort of in this part of the diagram, that's actually a horrible thing to do. The term that arises from due to the presence of this term is equally big as the term that comes from, say, the flat part. So as soon as the closer you get to scry, that approximation becomes worse and worse. So we need to keep this term. Now I can, you know, show you the solutions to this equation, but instead I'm going to do something slightly more interesting. I'm going to say, okay, what are, you know, the physical quantities that I can calculate from this? What is its energy? What is Young momentum associated to all of this? So for that, I need to tell you how to calculate these quantities. And we're not going to use any effective stress energy tensor or anything like that. What we want to use is the covariant symplectic framework, where if you have a Killing vector field, that naturally associates or gives you a Hamiltonian that is conserved. So doing that, you know, using this covariant symplectic framework, I first calculate the symplectic two-form, which I just obtained by linearizing the action and obtaining the potential and then getting the symplectic two-form. And it just has this particular form. So it's the scale factor squared upon 32 by g spatial integral of hab hd prime minus, let me see. So this is the formula for it. So what does this formula tell us? Well, this formula is nice. Let me comment actually. So these primes are derivatives with respect to eta, so with respect to conformal time. So this formula is nice. It's true on any constant slice. It doesn't matter what constant t slice I take. It's conserved. So I might as well use this to calculate quantities on scry, because that's where everything becomes simpler. So that's nice. So it's eta independent. The thing that's slightly less nice about this formula is that you need to completely gauge fix the solutions in order to calculate this. If you haven't gauge fixed the solutions, you're going to get spurious terms. So this is,
sorry,
you know,
here Q is the symmetric.
Ah, good. Sorry. Yeah, Q is the The flat metric on the spatial, the induced metric on the constant time slices, yes. The flat one. So.
No, they're not.
They all cancel.
Why your gauge fixing?
Sorry, I'm not. What is your question? No, in the flat case, you do have time and space derivatives. Here, you don't. You can integrate them. The ones that appear, you can integrate them apart and get rid of them.
Because your background is symmetric, or
yes, yes. It's this very surprisingly simple result. Maybe another intuitive way of seeing it is this equation looks very much like the wave equation for a scalar field in de Sitter, right? And this looks also much like the symplectic form for a scalar field in de Sitter.
So here the box is what? Is the box with respect to G or
with respect to G naught, this which is my flat metric.
But it contains a D over the eta.
Yes.
So
this is like my flat metric.
Then you also add the D over the eta square in your equation. I could not read that term. It's 2 over eta. Okay.
2 over eta, eta prime. Or h prime, sorry.
But why is it a spatial derivative?
In general, the symplectic structure contains, you know, all sorts of derivatives. If you don't restrict the type of deformation, you're looking at the combined symplectic potential.
It has four dimensions that it has aspect. So this is transverse space left gauge.
Yeah, so you're.
So in transverse space left gauge, you will.
Oh, yeah,
space.
So you are in transverse.
Yeah.
So that's why. You have already gotten rid of many.
So even in general,
yeah.
Because this is linearized at the moment, right?
Yeah. So all the H are transverse and
traceless. Yes. This formula is only true in the transverse traceless gauge. Yes.
Okay, good.
Now, that's something that you may not like so much about this formula. So I have another formula for you, which is true in any gauge. So let me show. That is 16 pi g h d 3 x e a b h c d minus e a b This formula is true in any gauge. And it's kind of miraculous.
What did it mean?
Oh, yes, good, thank you. E is the electric part of the linearized well tensor. And this is also, again, on, you know, any constant eta slice. This is true for any gauge. It's gauge independent. So this is. And you can obtain a relation between the two by looking at the solutions, or expressing the electric part of the well tensor, looking at the solutions, and you can relate the two very easily. And you can see that the resulting equation is completely gauge invariant. And sometimes, you know, for some situations, you might want to use this formula. For other situations, you might want to use this formula. And this formula also has sort of, you know, this form a little bit similar to the form from electromagnetism. So that's elegant about it, too. Now, let me use this two form to calculate energy. And I'll. Wow, this one has more options than the other one. OK, let me see. No, that did not work. OK, you know what? I'll just continue on this side. Is that OK for everyone there? Good. I'll figure. Oh, yeah, actually, if you can tell me how to do this.
Sure.
just need to press a bit longer.
Oh, longer, is that the key?
There's presets and there's...
The other, oh, nice. Good, perfect. Yes. Thank you. So if I use this formula to calculate energy, what do we get? So now this energy is calculated by feeding this symplectic two form that I have, the linearized field H and the lead derivative along my time like healing or time translation vector field A, of H. And then I get the energy. So what is it that it gives me? Let me check the factors. I get also 1 upon 16. Good. So on scry, I get 1 over 16 pi g h d3 x eab dt of h cd minus 2 h h. Oh, CD. Now, this energy has some interesting properties. So I would say lesson number 3, this can have an arbitrary sign. It can be positive, it can be negative, it's completely unbounded. And that's shocking, right? Because negative energies typically are an indication of instabilities. So this is looks bad. So lesson number 3 has an arbitrary sign. And to indicate how worrisome it is, let me draw this beautiful skull so you remember how bad it is. Now, fortunately, the situation isn't as bad as you might think, because for physically realistic systems, we were able to show that the energy is positive. Why? So, but if you restrict yourself to solutions that only have support in this part of your De Sitter diagram, then you're guaranteed that the energy is positive. So if you have solutions that are in there, then you know for sure that the energy is positive.
So support on which slice? Minus slice?
Oh, so I mean, if I have a slice here, if you only have support in this part, then the energy is guaranteed to be positive. Does it mean that if you also have support here, that the energy will be negative, but then this statement, we don't have a statement. And I'll argue later on why this is sort of the relevant part in when I get to the quadruple formula. So listen, before, you know, this looks bad, but there's hope that we still will be able to prove something like a positivity of energy.
And this is a statement about vacuum solutions.
So this is a statement about, yeah, perturbations around a De Sitter background.
With no other stress energy.
No other stress energy. Yes. Any other questions? So let me say, why actually do you think that this energy has an arbitrary sign? Why is that maybe as expected? Well, actually, it is as expected because, you know, generically, you have positivity if you have a time-like vector field. That gives for you the positivity. But here, as we can see, right, the vector field is space-like on scry. So there's nothing to tell you that the energy will have to be positive, right? Just as angular momentum, it can be positive, it can be negative. So that's why this also appears up here. Any other questions before I continue?
So why is it positive?
You can show that it's positive using some simple argument of completing the squares.
Yeah, but it's mainly because killing vector field is fine.
That's what you want to say. Oh. Yeah, so if you restrict to this side, thank you, Abhay, for pointing that out. So the reason why if you restrict here, it's positive, is exactly because here, you know, you have a time-like killing vector field.
But isn't that saying that you know, the fact that it's negative, it doesn't, it's not a sign of instability, it's just a sign that your killing vector is not, you know, you're not computing the translation generator of the time-like vector.
Well, there is no global time-like vector field.
That's it. So for momenta, so, you know, in the cell region, it's more like momenta, and there's no condition of positivity. So it's not that deadly. I mean, it's like saying that the momenta is not positive. It's not, there's nothing deadly about it.
Yeah, okay. There is not a strong statement that if this energy will be positive, that it will be unstable. But I'm saying generically, this may indicate problems.
Well, usually the problem has to do with causality. So positivity of energy is that the time of flow is forward, but for space-like direction, there's no.
But if I have some.
It's a problem of interpretation.
Okay.
Whether it doesn't, you know.
But if I have some system that's sitting here, say, and that is emitting gravitational radiation that carries negative energy,
no, but
that would be bad.
Your energy is a mixture of energy and momentum, right? Your like the charge you construct is a generator that sometimes generates time translation, in which case it's energy, and sometimes generates space translation, in which case it's momentum. Right. So for such objects, there's no.
Okay, you're not worried.
No, I'm not worried. It's more that, you know, instability is through time translation, not space.
Okay.
So I have another question.
Yeah.
So is this condition on having support in this shielded area? Can you pose it at one time slice and then it's automatically satisfied? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because the energy is conserved, so it's. Yeah, you can impose it on any time slice you want. Yeah.
So a comment about the instability thing. I mean, to make the instability argument with the negative canonical energy, usually you have to have like a positive flux. Some boundary, and then it becomes arbitrarily negative if it starts off because flux is positive and keeps making it go more negative. So do you have like a flux or anything to talk about? Through infinity? Or?
Through infinity, yes. That is what I'm calculating. That is the energy I'm calculating. Through all of infinity.
Yeah, okay.
That is an energy.
The generator is a translation of infinity, right?
Yes.
It's not something that just something that is parallel. You know.
But any killing vector field on infinity is going to be.
Yeah, it's going to be space.
Just like, yes.
It's going to be a translation generator.
Mm-hmm. Let me continue. Okay. Then. You may have been worried, or not at all, but you know, there are these factors of H appearing, and they're all down here. So the limit of sending lambda to zero is not so obvious. The reason why none of these things blow up if I send lambda to zero is because these fields also depend on lambda. Now, the limit is somewhat subtle, right? Because if I go back even to this metric, if I try to send H to zero, it blows up. So these coordinates are in some sense horrible to take the limit. And what we want to do is use a differentiable structure used by the proper time coordinates that allows you to take the limit nicely. So let me write that down. So lesson number 5, the limit of lambda to 0 is subtle. Use the structure provided by these coordinates. Which look like this. In these coordinates, it's obvious, right? If I send H to 0, I just obtain the Minkowski result. That's nice. Now, this limit is not entirely trivial, even in those coordinates, because conceptually, right, here I have an energy. Even if I take the limit, I do obtain the Minkowski result. But here I have an energy that can have an arbitrary sign, can be negative, can be positive. But in Minkowski space, I always know it's positive. So there is this entire set of solutions that somehow needs to give me something that's always positive in Minkowski space. So this limit is very can be very tricky, and that we could already see. You know, there are all these discontinuities. Even, you know, if you look just at the nature of scrying, it's either null or space-like. Dramatic discontinuity. That's also what's happening here. So that might be very interesting, because that means that there might be effects that will be present. We have a positive cosmological constant, but won't be there if we send the cosmological constant to zero. I'm not saying that there are, but that might be an option, right? This limit is subtle. So yeah, let me say, so E of t goes over to the one in Minkowski, where the Minkowski one is noted by a knot. And this is the time translation vector field in Minkowski. Any more questions? Then let me continue to the quadruple formula.
I actually have a question real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, is there something special about this particular choice? Because I can imagine an infinite number of foliations that would have the same properties that are. Another example would be the other one you drew, which is the static slicing. Why is this one the best? Or why this one and not others? Or just matters that one exists? Or I don't know.
I'm saying you cannot take an arbitrary one. You can take many ones that will be really, really bad. I'm just saying this is a good one.
Yeah.
I'm saying use this one. That's all I'm claiming. So now let's look at the quadruple formula. So let me first tell you what this quadruple formula is about. So Minkowski, this is this formula. Let me just write it down for you. And then I'll tell you what the physics of it is. So what is the physics of this formula? This formula tells us that if I have a gravitating system that is emitting gravitational radiation, the energy that is emitted per unit time by this system is dominated by this third time derivative of the quadruple moment squared. And this is, you know, very analogous to what happens in electromagnetism, right? So if I have a charge that is accelerating, then it will generically emit gravitational radiation, and the power is dominated by the second time derivative of the dipole moment squared. So here, this is the GR version of that. Now you may wonder, okay, why is there no dipole radiation? Here, there's no dipole radiation due to the conservation of linear momentum. So that's why the leading order starts with the quadruple moment. Now, this formula was derived by Einstein 100 years ago, and hadn't been really updated to account for the cosmological constant. And actually, that's understandable, because there are quite some conceptual things that you first need to figure out. First of all, you have to tell me, OK, what do you mean by power? Right? So I say, OK, it's energy per unit time. So that issue we have dealt with, since we here have this nice formula for the energy that is gauge invariant. But then you also have to say, OK, this formula is in terms of the quadruple moment. What are these quadruple moments? Like, these are also defined in Minkowski space. What are they in the sitter space-time? And third, in deriving this result, all the steps rely very, very heavily on the fact that you use this 1 up on R expansion. And we've learned that this 1 up on R expansion is not applicable in the sitter case. So there are, you know, all these little steps that you have to deal with. But we have been able to manage it. So what is the system that we're looking at now? in a de Sitter case, so say I have, again, half of de Sitter, and I introduce a star, or a black hole system, or whatever, something that is emitting gravitational radiation that just does nothing for a while, it wobbles, does nothing. And here it's emitting gravitational radiation that all ends up here. And now I want to know what is the energy that is radiated here at, say, this point. Now, why am I not caring about this part? Well, any observer that is restricted to this lower half of the sitter will not be able to see this system. So it's irrelevant for asking questions about gravitational radiation of this system. OK, so let me tell you what are the approximations that we're making, because of course, we also need to make some approximations. Otherwise, you'll never get to this result. And we're actually not assuming that much, surprisingly. So the physical assumptions are fairly mild. First of all, we assume that the physical size of the system is bounded for all time. So that sort of is supposed to capture the fact that, you know, despite the cosmological repulsion, this system is gravitationally bound, and you know, these binaries don't fly off. Now we're also saying, okay, the size of the system has to be smaller than the cosmological horizon, which doesn't seem like too strict of a condition for the systems we're interested in. Then the second assumption is maybe not very interesting. It's saying that the source can only be static for a finite time interval. So for a finite time interval. And that is just to guarantee that, that any integrals that we do and stuff are like nicely converging for time. And then the third approximation that we're making is that we as in, you know, wherever on this slice you're looking at this system, you're outside the source, which also seems like a reasonable thing to do. So this D is less than where you're looking at it. And this approximation becomes better and better over time. And in fact, this is not even an approximation anymore on scry. So those are the physical assumptions that go into the calculation. Now let me get the equation. Now we can solve the linearized Einstein's equations, which I guess they're on the other blackboard up there. Basically, they're the same as before, but now there's also a source. So I'm introducing a source that doesn't back react and that will, you know, generate for me these gravitational waves. And if I then solve the equations, what I get is that the gravitational wave has the following form. So there I go. It's 4g on r. Sorry, it's a long expression. But worth writing down, and I'll tell you why. So what is this expression? So this bar is just to denote that I'm taking a trace reversed part of my metric perturbation. Then this part is exactly the same solution that you would get if you were to solve this wave equation on a Minkowski background. Now, where does this part come from? This part is basically exactly due to the de Sitter background. This part is really interesting, right? Because it doesn't just depend on the retarded time. It depends on its entire history of what the source is. So this term physically tells me that in de Sitter spacetimes, these waves no longer sharply propagate along the null cone, but there's also this tilt term. There's this retardation effect. G due to the background curvature. And this order O are, you know, the terms that I'm neglecting in my approximation. So this term is really important. There is a tail term. Now, let me try this again on this side. Now the challenge is, now I have this waveform, I want to, I want to substitute it in the formula for energy that I just moved up to calculate the power. But here, as you can see, right, this power is in terms of the quadruple moment. So first, what I need to do is say, okay, what are these quadruple moments, and express my my gravitational field in terms of these quadruple moments. Now, what do I mean by a quadruple moment? Well, we came up with the following definition. We said the quadruple moment is the physical volume integral over the energy density of the source times the physical distances of the source. So what do I mean by that? So physical volume, that would mean that this goes like a to the third, eta d3x. And since these are distances from the origin from r equals 0 to this point x, and I want them to be physical distances, these go like the scale factor times xa. Now, this is a purely geometric quantity that depends on the properties of the source. And this is what I'm going to call my quadruple moment. Now, I can use the conservation of the stress energy tensor to express the my gravitational field in terms of these quadruple moments. So that's exactly the same steps that you would do in an asymptotically, or in a, sorry, in a Minkowski, in a flat space time. So using this, I can express this integral in terms of these quadruple moments. And what do I get? I get the following. Sneak in some extra labels. So what do I get? I get this. So this term is exactly the same as you would get in the flat space time. But there are a whole bunch of extra terms that you obtain because, you know, the conservation of the stress energy tensor is slightly different if you include the cosmological constant. Now, this rho, I mean the quadruple moment that I defined up here, but I could also, might as well instead, you know, replace this rho by a p, by the pressure. And that is something that we would call the pressure quadruple moment. So the interesting thing is that this volume integral over the spatial components of my stress energy tensor doesn't just relate to the energy density of the source, but also relates to the pressure. And that's why, in the end, inner energy no longer just depends on the energy density of the source, but also will depend on the pressure of the source. So now we have all the ingredients. I can use this, substitute it in there, substitute this form up in my equation for the energy, and obtain, finally, the formula for energy, or and power, let me write down the one for power, which is just the following. Let me write it like this. Where, of course, I need to tell you what this curly R is that we will call the radiation field. So this curly R is q triple dot ab plus 3hq double dot. And these are all energy densities of quadruple moments associated to the energy density. And then I have similar terms associated with the pressure. But these, of course, are all accompanied by extra factors of H, the Hubble parameter. Let me move it a little up so you can see it. Oh, no.
Last one might not move.
Which one moved?
The last one.
Well, it should, but maybe.
Yeah, that's what I, okay. Yeah, no. No, okay.
Okay.
Never mind.
Where are these integrals being performed?
So let me tell you where these integrals are performed. I first wanted to write it down. So
you want the previous
integral. These are on any constant time slice. And this one is only on scrying. But these fields, okay. These fields are evaluated at the retarded time. Now let me comment on the physical properties of this energy density first. So what shows up here is this radiation field squared. And in this radiation field, I don't just have this third time derivative of my quadruple moment. Right? There are all these additional terms. And in particular, there are also all these terms associated with the pressure. Now, this is maybe not so surprising because right, we know from the Ricciardi equation that pressure is gravitationally attractive. And here we see that it also is a source for gravitational radiation. Now, if I send the limit h to 0, all these additional terms go away, and I obtain back my formula in flat space-time. That's a good check. So where are these? So now let me answer Bai's question. So this R is a radiation field, and right, if I want to know the energy that is emitted here, so the power that's emitted at this point, what I need to do. That energy is completely defined on scry, but it refers back to what the source did at a retarded time. So it referred back to what the source did on this retarded time. Now, this is actually really interesting, right? Because I told you.
Which one?
So if I'm at this point, I just retarded time means that I'm going back along null rays. So I just go back to this point. If I look at this point, I just need to know what the source did at this point. And similar for any other point. Now, this is interesting, right? Because actually, I told you, wait, isn't there a tail term? Shouldn't the gravitational field depend on what it did in its entire past history? Are you lying to me? No, I'm not. Because it turns out that if I calculate the energy, what shows up are basically only derivatives of the gravitational field. And the derivatives of the gravitational fields actually propagate sharply along these null lines. So that's why if I want to calculate energy, and similarly if I want to calculate angular momentum or anything else, I still only need to know what the source did back at this retarded time. What else is interesting about this formula? Let me see. Well, yeah, we nicely obtained the Minkowski limit when we sent h to 0. Again, also, this is positive for exactly the same reasons that it was positive for these linearized fields, right? Because this source is, by one of our assumptions, always restricted to this part. And thus, the energy is emitted only in this part and will hence be positive here. Now, there's one small thing that I should mention. I nicely just wrote down this label TT. What does it mean? It means that I have to take the transverse traces part. Now, this TT only appears on one of them, not on both. And this is different from the asymptotically flat case, where you have them on both. And here, actually, you have them on both, and you have like these all these other nice techniques that you can basically take, calculate this TT part, which means that you have to take the transverse traces part of this tensor, using these algebraic projection operators. But these algebraic projection operators are, again, very closely tied to the fact that you use this 1/r expansion. You cannot use these algebraic projection operators if you don't have this 1/r expansion. So here, if you actually want to calculate this formula, you have to properly calculate what the transverse traces part is of this field. So that's a bit of a pain, because this algebraic projection operator is much easier. And if you want to calculate what this is, you have to solve a whole bunch of differential equations.
So taking the DT part is not a projector and just an encoder or something?
Yeah, this is not a projector. Yes. It's really saying that if you give me this vector field, I want.
Yeah,
I'm what I mean by this, if I give you any arbitrary, tensor, if I want the TT part, I want this tensor to satisfy the following properties. And traces. So I want it to be trans.
In spatial
areas. Yeah. One second. So I want it to be traceless. That part is, simplifying. I want it to be transverse to my time directions. And then on those slices, I want the spatial divergence to be zero as well.
So the space of functions is certainly a projection operator, as Bianca was saying.
Yeah, no, usually you can write TT on both things or one thing.
Right.
So you cannot move them over here? Oh.
Because it's not.
Sorry, this is not.
Orthogonal decomposition, but maybe it's not orthogonal with respect to this in a program. This is too deep.
Sorry, I should have told. Okay. Sorry, that wasn't my mistake.
So it's because of power.
That makes a difference, yeah.
Okay. Because of power. The flux.
Yeah, sorry. That. I hope that's also a two. This is also has been a two-dimensional integral all along, right? Yes.
I'm a tiny bit confused. So there's two confusions. One, I guess your h that you have here as a function of tx, but the right-hand side does not depend on tx. I guess this is just a small, let's say, because you're integrating over all x.
Oh. Prime.
And so where is the dependence then?
Here in the R.
Oh, just in the R. Okay.
No, yeah. Also in the R.
And in the T of R, in this retarded time.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
Where the X dependence is.
And the other one is, so now your formula for P is valid in the whole upper part of, I mean.
No, actually, so when I calculated this formula, it's only valid on scry.
Okay.
This field actually is valid on any constant time slice, but the approximation becomes better and better the closer we get to scry.
So it's valid on scry, but energy is not given by this expression that you wrote previously on scry, right? Because on scry, you don't have a time-like claim field. So.
I'm saying I use that time-like claim vector field to calculate what the energy is. Because the energy that's radiated through this part, sorry, the energy on scry, right, will have to be the sum of the energy through this surface, right, okay. Simply by conservation. Here I have my no incoming radiation boundary conditions. So all the energy that ends up on scry comes through this surface.
And there is no way that energy could be somehow created, or like.
At the linear level, no. No.
So okay. Because you could, if it was nonlinear, then you could have.
Maybe like directions.
Radiation creating extra radiation.
Yeah, I'm looking at the linear.
Nonlinear memory kind of stuff. Okay.
Now, there's one other thing that maybe some of you worried about. Hey, here in this corner, this is quadruple moment, and it doesn't appear with any dots, without any derivatives. Does that mean that the static source radiates energy in the sitter? And the answer is no. Everything still makes sense. Also in the sitter, if I have a static source, so that means if the stress energy of my source is Li direct by my time translation vector field, then there's no energy. And the reason is that even if I have a static source, that does not imply a static quadruple moment. So Li T of TAB 0 does not imply that Q dot has to be 0. And all the factors here sort of exactly conspire to, you know, guarantee that if this is 0, then this radiation field is also 0. You have any questions?
I'm still a little bit confused about where things are being evaluated. So like the quadruple moment, is that supposed to be a function on the sphere now or on the S on the two surface? I thought it was a function of time.
Thank you for your question. So the quadruple moment is associated to each time slice. So for example, if I take this point, right, if I want to know how much energy is radiated, what I need to do is to look at what the source did at this time. Now, at this time is where, you know, if I look at the constant time slice, this is where my quadruple moment is defined on. So my quadruple moment is a function of time, and it's, and what was the rest of your question?
So the quadruple moment is a function of time, but you're doing like an integral D2S. So
The D2S is, good. So good. Of these quadruple moments, you're saying?
Yeah.
Good. So this retarded time, the retarded time becomes, well, in these simple coordinates, the retarded time is, these coordinates, it's just this. So on scry, eta is 0, and it's a function of r.
I guess the question is, why don't you just factorize the integral over nothing depends on this, except the
transverse traces part. If this transverse traces thing wasn't there, I would be able to just perform this integral, right, for pi and be done.
Yeah, OK, that was my question.
OK, yeah, good question. Yeah, this is very, very tricky. Any other questions?
Is there any similar formula for ADS?
In ADS, actually, things are much, much simpler. Much, much simpler. There, you actually have a framework for asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes. So yeah, there are these formulas. In terms of the quadruple moment?
Any similar?
Actually, I haven't seen any quadruple formula for ADS. No, I haven't. Has anyone else seen it?
I mean, why would you expect the tension in ADS if you impose, depending on the boundary conditions you impose, it's just going to bounce off.
You have to come up with some boundary conditions, right, to make the problem with it. The standard boundary condition reflects the boundary condition, which says that there is no flux of gravitational waves at all. The energy is absolutely conserved in full nonlinear general relativity. So certainly in the linearized approximation, in the standard reflective boundary conditions, there will not be a quadruple formula because the energy is just reflected back. It doesn't go through square at all. So you will have to come up with some other boundary conditions in order to, I'm still making the problem well behave in order to create such a formula.
I'm curious about this tail. So if I'm not on scry, I'm at a fixed time hypersurface. I mean, you mentioned that on scry the power is 0 coming from this tail, but if I'm not on scry, can I boil water with the tail? is there real energy there?
I should clarify this tail term does contribute to the energy on scry. Okay. I'm just saying it doesn't show up as having this tail behavior because what ends up in the energy, right, is the time derivative of or the derivatives of this gravitational field, and these derivatives basically kill this tail term behavior. But in fact, on Scry, this term is equally important as this term, and it contributes equally to the energy. So yes, on Scry, you can boil water with this tail term. Absolutely. In fact, any time, as soon as you sort of cross this surface, that term is becoming very important. Yeah?
Could you comment a little bit more about the presence of this Q here and the relative strength of the term? So what does it mean to have a Q, you know, like a constant Q? You just mentioned what it is now, but you know,
what it is not. Okay, so...
Can you say a little bit more about...
Yeah. So these terms... So the leading term will still be, you know, this.
One on the top line, maybe.
The third time derivative of the quadruple moment is going to be the leading term. Just
any,
given...
Any situation, or you can imagine extreme situations,
let's say. So extreme situations... will be if you have these sources, the change in the behavior of the source be of the order of the Hubble time. Then yes, these terms can become important. Mm-hmm. Yes, but generically, you know, given the observed value of the cosmological constant, these terms are really small.
Maybe it looks like, okay, so what's wrong about this nice picture that the source is not moving very much? Then they become more important than, like, there's no time, you know. The time
they become really important? Yeah.
So
but if you...
When is that guy becoming really important?
Given, if I had an experiment where...
If there's a slow moving source, this guy will dominate. This is obviously slowly, but...
Yeah, but it's still multiplied by h cubed. Mm-hmm. Which is just a really small number.
But pressure is, for any realistic system,
pressure is usually very small.
Completely negligible compared to the density. So there's a factor of C that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So you need really
So therefore, I mean, one can work out, but I think it's
in the early universe, for instance, where, you know, maybe you have a lot of very small.
There is a
slowly varying stuff in the Okay.
Of course, in this approximation, I think they have just rolled down the new assumptions which are related to the cosmological constant. But of course, Einstein made other approximations, right? I mean, he's assuming that it is the source is weak, so you can use linear gravity, and he's also assuming that it is slowly moving, so that one is actually ignoring V cubed by C cubed and higher order terms up here. So those approximations are also there. So of course this V is always V by C. Mm-hmm. Here, even the, you're right, that if the sources are slowly moving, then V is more important. But because of 1 upon C squared factors relating the pressure and the density, it's still maybe subdominant, unless matter were actually moving. Mm-hmm. But then we have to, if the matter is moving that fast, then we're going to come back and look at the whole. But I think if at one stage one would be able to detect gravitational waves with extremely long wavelength, mm-hmm. then these first black holes that were formed, which are going around, like those gravitational waves, I think the other terms are going to be important. Mm-hmm. But it is not going to be the case for something like LISA. Even then, those terms are small. I think one has to see how small they are. In other words, it depends on how accurate LISA will be.
And what is the first correction effect? Is it like an overproduction of gravitational wave or an underproduction? Like, is it an enhancement?
Enhancement, yes.
So, theoretically, this is a way in which you could measure. It's tiny,
yeah. Any other questions?
I think you're asking this question earlier about the instability, right? So I think, yeah, you are completely right. Mathematically, this is a conserved quantity, and because momentum can be negative, we don't say system is even stable. I think here the statement is basically that, I mean, for a system like that, right, there is a time translation thing that like we were talking about, say, energy. But if it were, if it could happen, that it is actually emitting energy in the usual sense, in that region, the spinning racket is time translation. But then out there in space, so you could have a phenomenon like super radiance, right? That's exactly what happens with black holes and so on. Namely, the spinning vector is time translation is opposite. It's far away, it's time behind that, but in the ergo region, it's space time. So there, you could actually extract energy. So here, it could happen that somehow you arrange your matter cleverly so that you solve your energy problem. Because the matter gains energy, it just radiates out with negative energy. Total energy is conserved, it's not unstable, but you can solve the energy problem. You can actually get more and more energy. And the fact that this is not possible is really shown by the fact that the energy that is radiated away by this, by physically realistic sources, is always positive. Mm-hmm. So you cannot, a priori you could have done that. A priori you could have had, you know, like the Penrose process. But one doesn't. I think somebody else asked.
Sorry. That's what I said when I said you need positive flux.
Yeah, you need positive flux. So that's exactly what I'm saying. Yes.
You made similar arguments for super radiant instability in AES, trying to look at the flux argument.
Somebody else was asking about the about taking the limit. I don't know who else, but taking the limit.
Matt Johnson, he's gone.
He's gone.
Yeah.
So do you expect this property of the flux remaining positive even to be unaffected when you turn on non-linearities?
I hope this is remaining true, yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know if it is.
Okay, so you haven't.
There is no statement yet to be that I can make about this. These are all sort of like, you know, these little beacons, little guidances to construct the full framework. And then also, once you have the full framework, right, you should linearize it to make sure that you get back these things, right? They serve as checks. But it's hard to generalize from just this.
So for this energy you wrote down, were you saying that you just couldn't prove that it was always positive, or that there were some cases where it was actually negative, but those are?
There are some cases where it is actually negative, yes.
So like, yeah, some intuition for what an example of that would be and why it's unphysical?
So these are all homogeneous solutions that I talked about. So they're not, these are gravitational waves generated by what is it, gravitational fluctuations, but not by a source. So
you mean the second part of
that? No, I refer to the first part of you refer to the linearized fields, right, on a homogeneous vector.
Sure.
Yeah, so those fields are generated by, I mean, vacuum fluctuation. So, I would be more worried if I could construct these solutions if they actually came from a physical source, from say a binary or something.
Okay, so you're saying they just correspond to some source that's not.
So these homogeneous solutions correspond to no sources. Those are constructed in the absence of sources. So yeah, I don't know if we should be worried about them or not. These would be the.
What is the question precisely? The question is, should we be worried about them in what sense?
So I'm just wondering if you could like give some physical intuition to what these solutions that correspond to negative energy are and why they're unphysical.
So. So for example, Beatrice has written down this diagonal, right? And there, that's the corresponding to the horizon there. So basically, if you take the scaling vector in T, which is time-like in that quadrant as she did, this quadrant that she has, then that scaling vector field on the horizon is null and is pointing future there. And it vanishes at that point up here. And on the future, it's pointing from the past direction. So if you had any waves coming from the other side, then they will reach sky plus with negative energy with respect to this kilometer. So the statement is not totally unphysical. I mean, it's just that if you are looking at isolated systems, then as Beatrice was saying, maybe you didn't say that. This is a retarded solution that she wrote down, right? This Hij was a retarded solution that she wrote down. So that means that there is no flux that's coming in through that horizon now. But if you say that, well, I mean, somehow the universe is not that, the universe is the whole of the center space time. And there could be sources on this side which would be producing radiation. Sources on this side producing radiation. Then you choose a Kelly vector field adapted to the left hand side or right hand side, whatever. Then there will be actually the energy will be actually negative at sky.
That sounds like what Richard Woodard would probably use to make an argument that the city space is unstable.
Yeah, except that his argument really relied, I mean, he doesn't say it's classically unstable, he wants to say that it's really.
I know, maybe it's better than that.
I think as Laurent was saying, the fact that it's negative doesn't mean very much just because the Killing vector field is negative. I mean, it's future directed somewhere and past directed somewhere. So it's not really unstability. It's just sort of, you know, people do interesting things with it. But it's not really, at least class, in this picture, it's not unstable because the energy is conserved.
The chair wants me to stop.
No, just...
So if you have any other questions, I'm still here for a week.